Somewhere along the line, I and a whole lot of other people became captivated by the call of the wolf. And being so captivated, we paused to ask, why does the wolf call to us?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1,193rd edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Puerto Madryn who are tuned in to the podcast as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Folks, as a young lad hunting and fishing in the wilds of the Big Sky country of Montana, I was most grateful that all the hungry wolves had been dispossessed from those wilds. Nothing personal, mind you. Then, back in the mid-90s somewhere, I returned to the Big Skies to host a sheep rancher on a Food Chain Radio kitchen table remote. His ranch was in the lee of the Beartooth Mountains outside of Yellowstone Park, and those mountains filled up his kitchen windows. The show was about the reintroduction of wolves into the Yellowstone ecosystem, and I was there to get the rancher's side of the story. My rancher guest, however, did not have much to say about the reintroduction. "The wolves come and eat my sheep," he said, "and not much I can do about it." Fortunately for the radio show, a youngish man came bounding in through the kitchen door without so much as a knock. In his hand, he held a tracking antenna. And when he saw us sitting at the kitchen table, he said, "She's back." When the rancher introduced him as one of the biologists in the wolf reintroduction program, I talked him into joining us on the radio right there at the kitchen table. And I asked him, "Why are you bringing back the wolves? Is it to control the population of deer and elk?" "Oh, no," he replied. "We're bringing back the wolves because city people want them." And he was right. City people now travel to Yellowstone Park from all over the world to stand along the road in the Lamar Valley and hoping for a glimpse of a wolf or two or maybe even a pack. Why do they stand there, often in sub-zero temperatures, hoping for a glimpse of a wolf? Well, yes, I did find myself to be one of those standing along the road a time or two. And yes, I have seen wolves in the wild, and even better yet, I've heard them at dusk psych each other up for a hunt. And I have followed their reintroduction with a number of Food Chain radio shows throughout the years. But why? Why am I, and we, so fascinated by the call of the wolf? I think I found someone in Los Angeles area who can help us search for an answer. And he is Tale Alfaro, founder and director of the Wolf Connection Conservancy, the author of The Wolf Connection, and an associate tensegrity instructor. I knew I blew that tensegrity, but I got it finally. Tao, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you, Michael.
An Argentine in California to pursue tensegrity.
Yeah.
What is tensegrity?
It's a modern version of some traditional teachings. What brought me to California was pursuing the teachings of an author and anthropologist by the name of Carlos Castaneda.
Oh, don't we all know Carlos Castaneda?
Right. So his writings really captivated me in my 20s, and when I finished all his books, I thought I have to find this man. So my quest to come to California, he used to live here in Los Angeles, in Westwood.
Yeah.
So I came looking for him, and he died a few months before I arrived, which I didn't know. But I was lucky enough to come in touch with his colleagues and longtime apprentices. I became a student myself, and after 20-some years of that, I'm a teacher of that work.
Okay.
And he organized those teachings in a more modern version that he called tensegrity.
There it is. And with respect to tensegrity, it is kind of a study of a spiritual way of looking at the world, right?
Right.
Good. So then we go to the Wolf Connection Conservancy. What is the Conservancy?
Well, one of the concepts in the lineage and the teachings of Carlos Castaneda is that that we all must find our path with heart. What that means is that, you know, it's all good and dandy to do your spiritual practice in your cave and in your, you know, living room sitting, you know, in meditation. But at some point, you need to be able to apply that in the world and make a difference. And for me, that is Wolf Connection. It's a place where I can apply myself and apply all that I've learned over the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm. And the Wolf Connection is made up of a ranch up in the San Gabriel Mountains above Los Angeles there?
Right. We have a couple of 100 acres here in the mountains outside of L.A., a pristine piece of land that we rescue wolves and wolf hybrids and mixes all across the country from dire situations, from illegal ownership and abuse, neglect, abandonment, and we have some animals from fur farms currently, and we bring them to the ranch. We give them a permanent sanctuary, and care. We rehabilitate them physically, emotionally, mentally, and then they become ambassadors in the world of humans with a very important message. So they, we focus on serving the next generation for the most part. So we invite youth in foster care, youth in juvenile detention camps, some of them battling drug abuse. And so they do we have a whole very comprehensive, very involved empowerment and prison diversion program that we do with the wolves.
So you have a ranch, and on that ranch you grow dispossessed wolves and people and bring them together.
Yeah, it's a sanctuary. It's a sanctuary of for humans and people, and for mutual healing. I mean, that's the basic of the program. You know, humans and wolves have come together for millennia to help each other to co-evolve, to grow in a way in our evolution. Mm-hmm. and so we are tapping into that ancestral connection to provide healing and relief.
And your book, The Wolf Connection, tells a story both of the Wolf Connection Conservancy, but also our relationship with the wolves. And that's the story. Well, good. Away we go then. So we travel to Yellowstone Park and stand beside the road there in the Lamar Valley, and often in sub-zero temperatures, and hoping for a glimpse or two of a wolf. What is it about the wolf that calls us to do that, to stand there in the sub-zero temperatures and wait for just a sight of one of them?
Yeah, and I'm guilty of that. I mean, I've been there in the Lamar Valley, you know, having the time of my life without feeling my feet or hands. So I know what you're talking about. Look, science is beginning to confirm what indigenous traditions have been talking about for a long time, which is the wolf is the first animal we ever associated with. So if we are to look at our connection with nature and connection with animals, it all started perhaps hundreds of thousands of years ago in our connection with wolves. And so we, through genome discovery and exploration and study, scientists are beginning to see similarities in, first, the behavior that we wolves and humans have, and secondly, finding some moments in our history that evidence suggests that the wolves helped us literally survive and thrive. There's a, most recent time, it was, about 70,000 years ago during the last
Hold that one for just a second, because we're going to pick it up down the road here just a second.
Sounds good.
In the Wolf Connection, you write, at a fundamental level, I would go as far to say what we call humanness might have been, in fact, invented by wolves.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
What
I mean by that is, if we look, the language scientists use is that at some point over the last, 100,000 years or so, we stopped behaving like primates, and we adopted wolf lifestyle. We started behaving like wolves. So we started migrating like wolves. We started hunting like wolves. We started organizing. The most important one, you know, some of the things that make us human, right? Our moral code and our social structure, the way we relate to other humans, the way we organize ourselves in our families, in our small groups, you know, a small village or a small town, that's very similar or identical to the way wolves organize themselves. You know, the concept of the extended family, where the youth, the kids are being taken care of not only by the parents, but aunts and uncles and the grandparents and older siblings, that's exactly how a wolf pack works. Primates, not so much. Primates are a lot more competitive, and it's usually a relationship, you know, between parents and offspring, but not so much between other members of a clan or a group. Our migrating patterns, I already mentioned, our hunting techniques. You know, scientists go as far as to say some of our communication, some of our body language, some of the things that we do with our face, you know, how we, you know, show, move our eyebrows to show certain emotions, and how we search for meaning with the movement of our eyes. There's some studies done in the way how we can communicate with our dogs with just eye movement, you know, how the dog tracks your eyes for connection. And that's something that started, you know, like I said, perhaps tens or maybe hundreds of thousands of years ago in our relationship with wolves.
Mm-hmm.
Our moral structure, our moral code. You know, primates are typically more Machiavellian and taking advantage of each other. So, you know, so a primate would, you know, I will let you climb up the tree, you know, get the coconuts, drop it in the ground, and then I come and steal them. So you do the work, and I reap the benefits. Wolves, on the other hand, have these, they share risk and they share reward constantly. And they have ways in which they will go hunt, and they will bring food to the group, to the pack, for the old, the sick, and the injured, and the young. That's not primate behavior, that is wolf behavior, and we have that in every one of our households, you know, either the male or the female or both go out every day to hunt, you know, bring the bacon home, and for the young, and, if, you know, we have the sick, and many of us take care of an elder in our home, our, you know, an older parent or grandparent. So that's the claim that I make. You know, things that what really makes us human is our, you know, moral code, our emotional processing, our way to relate, and everything points to the fact that we might have incorporated or learned our modern version of that from wolves.
So way back when, we were a bunch of idiot primates swinging around the trees, stealing each other's fruit and nuts, and we climbed down out of those trees one day and had a good look at the way wolves were doing things. And man, they were so much more efficient and so much more social. And so we started looking at what they were doing and kind of adapting their ways and becoming more like them. Whoa. So, ladies and gentlemen, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, today we are talking about the call of the wolf with Teo Alfaro, founder and director of the Wolf Connection Conservancy and author of The Wolf Connection. Do stay tuned. Right back. We're going to go back 50,000 years. Don't go away.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Today we're talking about wolves, and not about just about wolves, but really about our relationship with wolves that maybe goes back 50,000 years or so. At least that's the contention of some, one being Teo Alfaro, who is the author of The Wolf Connection, and also the founder and director of the Wolf Connection Conservancy down there in the Los Angeles area, up above Los Angeles in the San Gabriel Mountains. And yours truly, Michael Olson. So way back, Teo, way back in Food Chain Radio number 1022, we featured Professor Pat Shipman in her book, The Invaders. And when you brought up in our last segment the notion that people actually communicate with dogs via their eyes and their eye movement. That was an essential message from Pat Chipman in her book, The Invaders. She talked about how way back when the Homo sapiens came out of the lands around the Mediterranean and invaded the territory of the Neanderthals. And somehow the Homo sapiens were able to supplant the Neanderthals, who disappeared. And Pat Chipman claims that it was because Homo sapiens were able to, in some way, domesticate the wolf. And the relationship made them a much more efficient hunter than the Neanderthals, who did not domesticate the wolf. And interestingly enough, Pat Chipman says the reason the Neanderthals could not, and this is speculation, the reason the Neanderthals could not domesticate the wolf is because they did not have the whites of their eyes, and their eyes were totally iris.
Right.
And so the wolf could not read their intentions, and so they could never make the connection.
Right. Yeah, so that's one theory.
Well, do you go along with
it? I think my sense is that that came a little later.
Ah.
I mean, I disagree with the whole domestication concept. I think, Pat Shipman did a great research, and I think she's drawing from older theories of wolf and mm-hmm. human relationship.
I bet you're going to tell us that we did not domesticate wolves, that wolves domesticated us.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a process of co-domestication. It was a process of co-evolution more than, the mighty human came and we, this theory that maybe some humans, came to, no one really knows how this happened, right?
All we can do is look at bone fragments and piles of bones and see who was in the bone, pile, which animals were there and which ones were being eaten and which ones were eating, and some things we can guess at.
Right, and we're looking at, a lot of these theories are part of one specimen that was found in Northern Africa or in Europe, and the whole global theory of human and wolf relationship gets formed after, one specimen that is found. So it's as you can imagine, extremely limited. The thing to take into consideration is that the way we see the world is infinitely different as the way the world was for humans 10, 50, 100,000 years ago. I mean, right now our intellect leads the charge, so we're trying to make sense of things and figure it out,
mm-hmm.
and then, find these claw marks in a specimen, in some remains, and then try to come up with stories. Through my training in the shamanic lineage of Carlos Castaneda and the ancient Toltecs and Aztecs, the relationship that an earlier man had with their environment was one of complete synergy. So there was a way to read in the air. I mean, the relationship. So thinking that some humans came or killed a female wolf and there was some puppy, they took him to the camp and then they kind of raised him as a pup and then that domesticated is really extremely simplistic in my opinion and leaves out the way early man would have this direct connection with the environment. I mean, that based on my research, the relationship between wolves and humans started with Neanderthals, not with the Homo sapiens.
Ah.
And that's based on mostly a few archaeological discoveries. One of them is in Spain, where they found some Neanderthal dwellings inside a cave. So there was a little wooden branch structure, a sleeping area covered with remains of hide. And then at the door of each of these sleeping dwellings, there was a wolf's skull. So that finding is 125 years ago. Wow. So that's the time of the Neanderthals, right? So the transition between Neanderthals and Homo sapiens. But if Neanderthals were already doing that, that suggests an earlier, longer relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And now there's another finding in northern England. In a cave, they found human remains and wolf remains buried in close proximity to each other. If it was ceremonial or you know, the human was buried and then the wolf was buried a year or two later or vice versa, is to be determined. But they're buried in close proximity and within a short period of time, and that's 500,000 years ago.
Long time ago. So
a long, long time ago. I mean, you know. So we're looking at, and of course, the implications of that is we can only guess, but definitely there was some significance to the wolf-human relationship. I mean, wolf remains don't bury themselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, Teo, if we did not domesticate the wolf, how did the wolf domesticate us?
What I think it happened is, I mean, there's another, you know, von Holt and other scientists now are looking into, you know, with the study of the genome, they're finding the hypersociability gene, which is all we humans have and canines have as well. So,
hold on to that. So geneticists have identified a gene, a hypersociability gene,
right,
that encourages us. It's kind of like the software program that tells us that we need to be very, very, very sociable.
But it's almost pathological. I mean, this is the person that will come to visit for a little bit in an afternoon, and it's 11 o'clock at night, and they're still
here,
right?
Their
fourth beer, and they don't seem to have a clue that it's late and they need to leave, and you need to go to work in the morning.
So people have this gene, and so do animals.
Right, right. It's chromosome 7 for humans, chromosome 6 for canines.
For canines.
So there is geneticists are drawing this other theory through the hypersociability gene, and it's actually fairly common. I need to look at the data again, but I think it's, 1 in 10 humans have it or something like that.
And so we all know somebody like that, right?
It's frequent.
Yeah.
So it's a frequent occurrence. So there's a good, this theory now says that a wolf with this hypersociability, I mean, remember, humans, we were in that environment constantly. We were not going to the Amara Valley with
right, you know, right. COVID. We were looking at it with binoculars.
We were mingling with all this wilderness and on a daily basis. One of these, wolf, possibly a yearling, or approach a camp, being hypersocial, wagging the tail. The other thing with the hypersociability seems that is rejected by the actual wolf. So a wolf with hypersociability would be seen by the pack as a liability because it's a little noisier and likes to play more and is, you know, a little unfocused. So it could be driven away by a wolf pack.
Or even killed. Or even killed.
Or even killed. Yeah. So a solitary youngling that was just maybe driven away or beaten up by their pack or their alpha may have wandered into an encampment and just sit by the fire. This is what the natives say. The Dene people in the Pacific Northwest, they say actually the wolves came and just sat by the fire.
Mm-hmm.
That's how they say the relationship started.
It's as simple as that, ladies and gentlemen.
They came
the wolf
sat by the fire and didn't leave.
Feed me. And if you feed me, I'll watch your camp tonight so that nobody will approach.
Well, that would coincide with the domestication thing.
Yeah.
I think they come sat by the fire, left and came. I mean, I don't think there was ever a touch or a pet or a scratch in the belly or anything like that.
Right.
I don't know if they actually needed feeding. Maybe they got some scraps, but maybe this wolf, could live regularly and catch a rabbit or catch a small prey and then feed themselves.
Sure.
Maybe even bring a little bit of prey to the camp.
But they're really there because they just want to be sociable.
Exactly. Yeah. And there's a chance, Bridget Van Holt talks about it's a chance that this wolf was a female, mm-hmm. and then had pups, and some of these pups, I mean, this hypersociability gene can be hereditary, so half those pups may have it, you know, and those states, so that, and of course, we're talking about a process that maybe lasted hundreds or thousands of years.
Right. 500,000 years going back, so we had some time to work with this situation. Now,
Now through the genome mapping, they have determined that the split between wolf and dog genome happened 40,000 years ago, which is much earlier.
It's almost like yesterday in terms of the 500,000 year history, though.
It is, and earlier theories believe that it was much is later, so that, you know, the dog appeared 10,000 years ago. Now we know it's 40,000, which means that if the human was already inbreeding wolves for certain traits, we think the main trait was sociability, mm-hmm. so they kept the most social animals and breed them together, and those would give more social offsprings. And then they started selecting for coloring, for aggressiveness, for, you know, and then the dog, you know, all the dog breeds that we know were born.
Just 40,000 years ago.
Right, 40,000 years ago, the split of the genome happened. That clearly suggests that our relationship with wolves is
goes much longer.
Earlier, yeah.
Well, let's see, 500,000 minus 40,000, that's like 460,000 years of working together.
Right.
Now, you made mention of something we've all heard about in indigenous folklore, and that is the orphan child that gets adopted by a wolf pack.
Right.
How does that work?
Well, I mean, so we both have heard, you know, the Native American or the First Nation stories about wolves. What I did for the book is partnered up with a researcher, and we went all around the globe and we started looking for wolf legends that may not have been as known. So we found, you know, Tibetan wolf legends, and in Turkey, and Chinese mythology, and Japanese mythology, and all throughout Europe and Russia. So, and it's a very common topic, you know, the kid, the orphan, the runaway that gets adopted by a wolf. You know, definitely, you know, the founders of Rome were breastfed by a she-wolf. It's a very common, and vice versa. I mean, there's many legends about the young wolf that came and lived with the pack. So this relationship between humans and wolves have been recorded for millennia, to the point that some tribes, they consider themselves to be, you know, descendants of wolves, or, you know, the creator of all things saw two wolves in a land and ordered them to stand up, to take their coat out, and those were the first two humans.
Mm-hmm. Right? And so, all cued to a gene, a sociability gene, a hyper-sociability gene. You tell the wonderful story of Romeo, the Juno, Alaska's wolf dog. Would you tell that?
Well, I mean, definitely, you know, better told on the book, you know, Wolf Called Romeo. Brigid Van Holt, the geneticist I mentioned earlier, UCLA, she's referring to that wolf as a possible hypersocial wolf. Because this is a wolf that was documented seen in Juneau, Alaska, that all of a sudden showed up in a population by himself and stayed for a number of years until he got shot at a parking lot. And he became an iconic presence in this village where he would be observed playing with dogs and coming, and I don't believe he was ever petted or he really approached people in a way like a dog would, but he was always at the edges of the forest, being curious, coming to interacting with people, interacting with dogs, I mean, not much to say. The theory is that that was a hypersocial wolf, probably abandoned his pack or was driven away, and then lived the rest of his days
On the outskirts of town. Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, probably in a way that earlier wolves and early men, related. I mean, it's not the relationship we have with a dog, but it's a proximity. I mean, there's definitely an acknowledgement of each other's presence.
Well, good. This is the food. Now, there are no wolves left in the world, as I understand it. Almost all of them have dog genes in them now. So they're kind of all hybrids now, correct?
Yeah,
genetic
point of view. Yeah, I mean especially the black. The black coloration is not a natural coloration in wolves.
Ah,
not through.
We're going to have to take a quick break. But when we come back, I'd like you to take us to the conservancy, and tell us about the interaction of people with wolves.
Absolutely.
This is the Food Chain, Michael Olson. With Teo Alfaro and you, we're going to come back. We're going to talk about what happens when troubled people meet troubled wolves at the conservancy.
So much to say, so little time to say it on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, we love saying it here on the Food Chain. Today, folks, we're looking at a relationship with wolves, and I don't know if you've ever had that possibility of making a connection with wolves. I have had a number of them, and each one has some way of really touching me. I think one of the most dramatic was of an evening in the Paradise Valley of Montana. My wife and I were staying with some friends, and we were talking about the wolves, and they said, "Oh, if you want to, you know, get to know the wolves, just go up to this road right here, and you'll hear them, or maybe even see them." So, and when the sun was setting, we went up to the road, and we had a nice glass of wine, and sitting in the hood of the car, and we heard the wolves come out of their den, and we heard them work themselves up into a hunt, and by howling and talking with each other, and we never did see them, but we heard them, and we heard them, and the cattle down in the valley heard them, and they started mooing and going, "Oh no!" It was quite an experience, and it goes way down deep, that howl of the wolf, the call of the wolf, and there's something about it that is much more than the physical presence. They're much more than running across a pack of dogs. There's something about the call of the wolf. Teo Alfaro says it's because we had about 500,000 years of working with them. And in fact, they made us more human than we made them. And we trained them. And Teo, you make that claim because you say we followed their ways, right?
Yeah, we followed their ways. I mean, I would say, I don't know, you know, who impacted the other the most, but I would say probably equally, wolves have changed our ways probably as much as we have changed theirs into
domesticated.
Into the domestic domestic dogs. Look, the call of the wolves, the call of the wild, have been captivating us for time immemorial. I mean, the native people of Canada, they say that the wolves taught us how to sing. The vocalization and singing and perhaps language to an extent was born by hearing and imitating wolf calls.
Well, that's an interesting. They do sing to each other, and they do communicate with each other via that song. Do they not?
Yeah. They have 32 different vocalizations that we know of that include many many tones of howling and grunts and whines and growls, and it's a very very complex vocalization. And then they add that the body language, which is very rich, facial expressions. You know, if you think about it, not too many animals have facial expressions. I mean, you can look at a bear, at a horse, at a cat, at a, alligator.
Yeah.
I mean, they don't have, wolves have eyebrows, and they have smiles, and they have, all kinds of movement with the ears, with the shoulders. I mean, they're so, so expressive physically, and then with their sounds, of course.
As do dogs, too, then.
Right, as do dogs,
as
yeah.
As do dogs.
Yeah. And as do humans.
Mm-hmm. So the Wolf Connection Conservancy, you bring, I guess, dispossessed wolves to your conservancy, to your ranch there in the San Gabriel Mountains above Los Angeles, and you tend to them, which is to say, you heal their wounds, both emotional and do wolves have emotions, by the way?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, they, I observe them expressing sadness and loss when one of their own dies. They express joy and they express, gratitude and bonding. And and I say joy and I don't say happiness because happiness seems to is more like a human emotion, but it's definitely a way to express joy.
You've seen wolf pups play, it's almost like joy.
It's all, yeah, right, like human pups.
Mm-hmm. Play. Exactly.
But, mostly joy, and then they have, they cry less than a human pup would cry.
Yeah. So you have these troubled wolves, and you work with them, and you help them heal.
Yep.
And now you combine them with troubled youth,
right?
And you bring them to your wolf conservancy, and you bring them together.
Right.
So I think a great way of describing this relationship would be to tell the story of Michael and Kira, the wolf.
Yeah, so Michael was a young man when he came, and he was in foster care, and he, anybody familiar with foster care, there are several layers of care, and depending on the child functionality, they are placed on those different levels, and some of which, look a little closer to a prison, right? The high level, they call level 14 care, meaning if the kid is aggressive and is violent, they are medicated and they are placed in some lockdown facilities for their safety and the safety of other people.
And when Michael came to you, he had an armed guard.
Right. He was not armed, but he had a couple of security, chaperones. That because he had very violent tendencies, he attacked his caretakers, he threw things out the window, punched holes in the wall. So he was about to be placed on a lockdown facility because of his violent tendencies, and didn't respond to any therapy. He was nothing. He would not respect anything or anybody. Very angry, very hurt young man. And he immediately began bonding as he came with Kira. And Kira had a similar, story of being placed in multiple, she was kicked around and placed in different homes and then abandoned and again. And when she came to us, she was in pretty bad shape, broken teeth, chewed up ears, seemed like she was beat up and in many different ways, under malnourished, riddled with fleas. I mean, she was in very bad shape. And so Michael identified with that. He was like, that's her, Kira's story is my story.
The two of them had a lot to share.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So without language, in an unspoken, in a just through the encounter, Michael found a reason to get up in the morning, a reason to cope with his emotions. I mean, the conditions to come a Wolf Connection is that, once the youth start coming to the program, they need to be able to take the lessons they learn from the wolves into their lives. So if they're, if they get suspended at school or get into fights or they are not able to come the following week. So there's a real life consequences for the behavior. So he began finding ways to self-regulate, to walk away from fights,
behave.
Stop being aggressive, behaving. So, and the reason was, he was coming to Wolf Connection. He had to come back, and he would say, well, I need to go back because Kira is there waiting for me. I need to go, right? So that would be the day he would wake up in the morning, brush his teeth, do his room, do his bed, and all the things. And within a couple of weeks of coming to the program, he asked me to help him, to teach him use tools. So now he has this violin man that I'm letting him use a hammer and a screwdriver and a saw, and soon we are cutting trails, so he's wielding a machete.
Little bit of trust there, huh?
Full trust. I mean, he never gave me a reason not to trust him. I told him that I would trust him implicitly, and he never betrayed that trust. He never misused any of the tools. He was never, never cross. Probably
nobody had ever trusted him before.
I imagine. And that mistrust was triggering his reactions as well. So, long story short, he asked his caretakers at the group home where he was at to buy him a utility belt. So now he's walking around the house with a hammer and screwdrivers and some screws, some tools, fixing the things that he previously broke, and then being a role model for his peers and breaking up fights among other kids, and I mean, it was a 180 transformation that he did, and to the point, I mean, him and I remain connected. I mean, he really touched my heart in many ways, and so I was able to see his progression. Wolf Connection completely changed his trajectory. He was not placed on a high-level security placement. He began applying himself at school. When he graduated high school, he came, he was 16 years old or so. When he graduated high school, he was the president of the student council. he was dating a young woman. I mean, he had plans to go to study to college for political science.
That connection with the
completely.
Wolf.
Yeah, completely.
So
what we're doing at the ranch is really tapping into this ancestral bond. I mean, this connection, I mean, the theory that I present here at the ranch is that this ancestral bond is at a primal level that is underneath or beyond any socialized learned behavior. So when these kids that cannot function at a social level connect at a primal level with the wolf, all of a sudden they allows for a factory reset, if you might, where things start making sense and they find their own inner confidence. And from there, you can build up any life you want.
Well, you know, one notices that there are a number of different kind of animal therapy programs around. You see quite a few of them relating with horses.
Yep.
I heard of one even that connects people with sharks, but there's something not there.
Does that work with Wall Street?
Yeah. So there's something not quite there like there is with the wolf, and
right.
It perhaps relates to that 500,000-year history that we have working with them side by side. Going through nature and trying to figure out how to manage our lives with nature. You make mention of the realms of the wolf, nine realms of the wolf,
right,
which, of course, we could probably spend about 12 hours on.
Right.
But one of them, realm five, the human wolf.
Right.
Let's start with territory.
Well, in that chapter, I make the case that we briefly discussed earlier, you know, the wolf reflects the good, the bad, and the ugly. So the wolf is, in my opinion, the mirror that we have in the natural world to see ourselves not only as individuals, but as a species.
Mm-hmm.
And so, it reflects the deep bonding and love that humans are capable of. Also reflects, some people see the wolves and they see the devil. They think it's devil worshipping and they need to exterminate as a religious mandate. And so we see in the wolves the reflection of our heart and soul. And that's the principle that I make. And I divide the chapter into territory and self and so on, just to find a context to explain this
You know, one of the
claim that I make. Yeah,
yeah, right? One of the interesting things that you made mention of is how we're often clueless about our ancient origins and the habits that we've developed through the millenniums. And you talk about dogs, you know, how we watch our dogs and how we often see our dogs walking in a circle before right. they lay down in bed.
Yep.
And we see them take a dump and then walk 20 feet away and scratch the ground. Going,
right.
What are you doing? What is that telling us?
Well, the dogs have these leftover instincts. You know, they walk in a circle in your kitchen tile floor, right? But in reality, when you see a wolf doing that in the wild, they're either, you know, pushing down the grass and, like, creating a bed or packing the snow to lay down. So there's a purpose to that walking in circles. The dog will walk in circles in your hardwood floor and then lay down. And so there's leftover instincts that they don't know what they do it, but they do it. And we humans have the same. We have, it's almost like we have left our connection with the natural world behind in this creation of this, you know, artificial world that we're all living. And I'm not claiming that the solution is to go back to living in huts and on dirt floor and hunt barefoot. Not at all. But there's something to be reclaimed in our ancient connection with the natural world that if we are able to incorporate it into our technological advancement that we have today, we might be able to create an extraordinary life for every human being, not just for a few. And as the dominant species on this planet, if we get a clue and we get our stuff together, then we can really create an extraordinary life for all living beings. Which right now, that's not the case.
Is that not what the Bible tells us to do when it tells us to take dominion?
Yes, I mean, I'm not a scholar on Bible studies. I grew up Catholic, so I have read the Bible and so on.
We're just running out of time, but I just want to say it's worth a read, folks. Teo Alfaro, The Wolf Connection. Worth a read. Thank you, Teo. Much appreciate your presence today. What a wonderful show. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael, for your questions. I really appreciate being here.
You bet. Bye-bye. Well, thank you, folks.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends miss the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.